Thank you. It's really great to be here, and thanks, Anthony, for the invite, Ben, for all the sort of work within the project, Linda for organising, and Suzanne for organising. So I'm really happy to be joining you. I've just returned from Delhi, where I was attending a conference that sought to elaborate post-colonial perspectives on world literature. And I'm feeling really, you know, freshly struck by the rift between these places that are said to be variously of the South, and yet are at the same time worlds apart. So I visited Delhi twice before, but on previous occasions I embarked from Cape Town, which is in some respect of that world and in some respects of this world, while also itself being simultaneously exemplary and exceptional in its Southness. So it's really, you know, pushing me to keep asking the question of what is the slippery thing that we try to net in the word South. My sinuses have also not responded well to Delhi air. They don't respond well to Johannesburg air either. And so I'm feeling a bit dull and clogged up. And excuse me if I cough or splutter and read a bit. Okay, so as I try to, you know, think through these different, I suppose, shifting tectonic plates of the South that I've been sort of moving between, I think for much of my intellectual life, really previously working very much in the sense of the global South, of the post-colonial South, I want to start trying to approach and define an area that is the geographic South or the Southern Hemisphere, and then I think to move from there back into ideas of global Southness and to think about what the relationship is between it, because I think we need to work betwixt and between these different conceptions of the South if this idea is to have any currency. Okay, so what I'm interested in doing at the moment is in thinking Southern by degrees, to quote the title of a recent piece by the South African scholar Isabel Hoffmeyer. So in other words, this is the South that lies between the equator and the pole, or between the 0 to 90 degree parallels. And it's distinct from, while at the same time overlapping with, the global South. Okay, that other South that is delimited by the Brandt Line, which measures GDP and distinguishes between the richer and poorer nations or the developed and developing world, which largely meanders along the 30-degree parallel north before scooping up around Mongolia and China and then veering down around Australia and New Zealand. So as I said, you know, I think the really interesting place to get to is the point of overlap and the fault line between these two cells, but I'm going to be thinking southern by degrees in this paper. And to think southern by degrees is also to observe a gradated rather than an absolute distinction that might hopefully shift us out of some of the entrapping binaries of north and south while still being able to register differences between them. Okay, so the particular gradated distinction that I want to foreground is the differential distribution of land and sea in the two hemispheres. Oceans and seas comprise approximately 80% of the surface area of the South, compared with 60% of the North. So we may live on a blue planet, but the Southern Hemisphere is somewhat bluer than its northern counterpart. And I think this distinction matters, albeit by degrees, albeit a gradated distinction, and that it is a substantial one. So the idea I want to start floating, perhaps at the confluence of Southern theory and oceanic studies, although I don't yet do so, and we can perhaps talk about that later, is the idea of the blue Southern Hemisphere. This may suggest that I'm reaching towards an unmoored state, and I will indeed pass through that soon. But I'm instead interested in evoking this idea of the blue Southern Hemisphere in order to frame Southness as a literal condition. So to put it boldly, we live in this hemisphere on relatively isolated strips of land surrounded by relatively vaster expanses of water. And my proposition is that this is both essential to our experience of here-ness and a potential prospect on the world or planet. So to say this is to recast the sense of living at the ends of the earth from the pejorative expression of peripherality to a more positive but also more thoroughly ambiguous and unstable state. It is to conceive of the South not as an antipodal condition, but instead as an ecotonal one, as amphibious rather than back-footed. Okay, so that in broad strokes is the idea I want to work up in months or years to come. For the remainder of this paper, I'll just simply be penciling in some detail with reference to the writing of J.M. Coetzee, largely because more than any other writer today, I think he manifests that potential configuration of literatures of the South, but also partially because of the writers that are in my archive, he's perhaps most likely to be familiar to you. So I hope that some of my readings will resonate. Coetzee is, of course, most often thought of as a writer of the arid interior, of the heart of the country, or of situations that float free of their spatio-temporal coordinates. But the seaside, in fact, enjoys a pivotal, if minor, place in his fiction. And if you start looking for it, it's there at really keynote places throughout it. This was already evident in his contribution to the event on the South that the Other Worlds Project organized in Adelaide last November, where he read from the last pages of his second novel, In the Heart of the Country, which he introduced as a novel of the South. And the excerpt he read included among various recollections of a life lived in the Karoo, in the dry land, the memory of a visit to the seaside. And I've come to recognize this as a recurrent trope in his writing. On the occasion of the particular reading that I'm referring to, Coetzee also insisted that the South, which he speaks of, is not the other of the North, that part of the world which doesn't have economic or cultural power, doesn't have ideas, and is dependent on the North. And this echoes the point that he reportedly made in a lecture in Buenos Aires the year before, where, according to James Halford, who is my source on this lecture, he distinguished the real South from both the mythic South of the metropolitan imagination and the global South of the geopolitical order. The purpose of identifying this real South, he apparently goes on to suggest, is to liberate literatures of the South from the imperative of writing back to the center and to enable them to instead see the South as home. I'm quite intrigued by the resonances of this phrasing with Coetzee's earlier novel, Foe, and the interpretive frames that have been placed on it. Okay, so one of these frames would cast it as a post-colonial riposte, an act of writing back to empire. And the character Susan Barton is, of course, much exercised by her attempts to place Friday, to find his home, which she at one point identifies as being Africa, and she tries to send him back there. In the final section, a new extra-diegetic narrator, one who is often taken as a figure of the author, is transported through writing onto a rowing boat before slipping overboard into these unfathomed waters that are instead identified as being the true, perhaps we should say now, the real home of Friday. And there he finds issuing from Friday's mouth a stream that is planetary in reach, with all the Spivakian overtones of that word. But what grabs my attention is the craft that conveyed the narrator to this place, and which has been left on the surface. Gripped by the current, we are told, the boat bobs away, drawn south toward the realm of the whales and eternal ice. Just remember that this novel was published in 1986, so it's way before the current project. Now, it's also to this realm of the whales and eternal ice that Mrs. Curran's thoughts fly in Coetzee's later Age of Iron, published in 1990, when she seeks to detach herself from the oppressive urgencies and sordid complicities of the South African situation. And it is here, too, that the lesson on the novel in Africa is delivered in Elizabeth Costello in 2003, when it's published together. So what Mrs. Curran describes in Age of Iron as this most neglected of oceans, the Southern Ocean, has by the time of the novel in Africa been incorporated into the global system in which, to quote from it, it had been allotted to Africa to be the home of poverty and in which the sole currency of the African author is his exoticism. So much for the Southern Ocean then. But it does, however, continue to frame a space in which Coetzee locates the South, particularly in the first two volumes of the quasi-autobiographical trilogy, Scenes from Provincial Life. As many have noted, while these plot the protagonist's escape to the metropolis, their writing and publication coincides instead with Coetzee's own move along the southern latitude that runs between Cape Town and Adelaide. And this is a journey that I have myself recently traced, actually just a year ago, not a few years ago. So there's inevitably a fair dose of desire and self-making in my argument, and not all of it will be obviously visible to me. So you might want to push me on that later, although it seems to me that that might be a more confronting South African thing to do in a seminar. I might not always feel comfortable in the Australian Academy. So what I want to do is just keep marking these fault lines. You know, what is the South? How do we think across these spaces? So back to youth. Okay, so the trajectory of the plot is carrying John away from his despised provincial lot. I'm quoting from a talk that Coetzee gives in 1980 to sort of rehabilitate the notion of the provincial, to what he calls the library of all libraries in the British Museum. There, however, he's able to re-enter the country of his heart through the travelogue of the 19th century naturalist William Burchell. And he recognizes that if he were to write an account of this country, his would be alive to it in a way that Burchell's is not. So it is here then that he formulates his intention to write a novel set in that country, the country of his heart, and to lodge it in this library of all libraries in the metropolis. And of course, this is also the wish of Coetzee's Australian novelist, Elizabeth Costello. But there is more to this scene in the British Museum than an arrived author wryly mocking his earlier provincial desire to either transcend his background or exploit his marginality. Sorry, there's more to the scene in the British Museum than an arrived author wryly mocking his earlier provincial desire to either transcend his background or to exploit his marginality in order to open a place on the metropolitan bookshelf. This something more lies in the force with which John is struck by the indexical sign pointing to southern skies. Real stars glimmered above his head, he thinks of Burchell. It dizzies him even to think about it. Okay, so that giddiness that he experiences, it's of course expressive of the proprioceptive sensation of reorienting himself, spinning around to face south. And I think it's a key marker in the fiction. It is of course common cause that between this encounter with Burchell and the discovery of Beckett in Charing Cross Road, youth shows its author finding both his subject matter and his style. But less remarked upon is the encounter also related in these pages with the poetry of Pablo Neruda, which John reads in a dual language edition and which he will later go on to introduce at the University of Cape Town, which Coetzee will later go on to introduce at the University of Cape Town. And in some of these poems, he may have recognized a shared literal condition framed by blue. Certainly that geographical reorientation, dizzying, spinning around that he experiences in the British Museum has been anticipated on one of the few occasions in which his thoughts return to his homeland in youth. In South Africa, it is summer, he thinks, during one particularly bitter English winter, thus marking the hemispheric difference. If he were there, he could be on Strandfontein Beach, running over mile after mile of white sand under a great blue sky. The expansiveness of this gesture belies the stunting belief that his provincial origins constitute a handicap, and which his dreary tramps through the labyrinthine streets of London seem only to confirm. It is, I think, significant that it is located in the south, in a south that is rendered here as Strand. After all, John's first experiment with prose is said to be set on a beach, and one that is both so distinctive and so essential that he does not bother to publish it, assuming that its substance will be lost to an English readership. For the beach in the story, they will summon up an English idea of a beach, a few pebbles lapped by wavelets. They will not see a dazzling space of sand at the foot of rocky cliffs pounded by breakers, with gulls and cormorants screaming overhead as they battle the wind. For some readers, the rocky cliffs pounded by breakers might recall Louis Camus's embodiment of the Cape in the monster Adamastor, who guards the southern boundary and becomes archetypal in later South African white writing of a continent that repulses its presence while remaining subject to invasion. Coetzee does indeed situate the shore in these terms when elsewhere in use John reflects on the untenable claim laid on South African soil by descendants of the handful of Hollanders, I'm quoting, who waded ashore on Woodstock Beach in the mid-17th century. It's just worth recalling that there are very few backward glances to South Africa in this narrative, focalized by a character who is truly eager to shake the provincial dust off his feet. And the fact that the few that appear should heave so consistently to the shore is, I think, remarkable and warrants further reflection. This is not to claim that at the moment of his departure, Coetzee retreats finally to the category of South African literature that he's chafed against throughout his career. On the contrary, what he's doing here, it seems to me, with the benefit of hindsight, is opening up the category of the South and encoding it in the luminous liminal space of the shore. This might be a particular beach, but it is also a generalizable one across this hemisphere. It's notable, then, that the reference in use to Hollanders arriving on the Woodstock Beach is echoed in Slow Man when Paul Raymond describes how his stepfather, the Dutchman, delivered his family to, I quote, the sunny land of opportunity at the ends of the earth. Rather than read Slow Man as an achieved or failed Australian novel, we might again see it as elaborating a southern position, one in which the ends of the earth do not reference an antipodal relation to the north, but are instead their own, its own, unsettling, unstable ground. Subsequently, as we know, Coetzee has extended his reach to South America, where he has convened seminars on literatures of the South. And I'm again struck by the constellation of writers that he's drawn into this project. The Southern African authors whom he has invited to Buenos Aires include Mia Kuta, Anki Kroch, Ivan Vladislavich, and Zoe Wickham. One of Kuta's novels, translated as Under the Frangipani, but more properly referring to the veranda of the Frangipani, describes Mozambique as one great balcony over the ocean. And Zoe Wickham, who, like Coetzee, centers much of her fiction on the arid interior, draws to the Cape Point at really pivotal moments in her fiction. I've actually been, for many of the last years, reading them both as exemplars of what I've been trying to theorize as coastal form or an amphibian aesthetic. So it's really intriguing to me to see them both drawn together under the rubric of the South in this way. Even Ivan Vladislavich, whose horizon is the Witwatersrand gold reef, has invited us to receive the Highveld in marine terms, to read that reef in marine terms, and he's asked his readers to hear the pound of the surf in the city's traffic, which he likens to a shell that we might hold up to our ear. And Anki Kroch, the famous barefoot poet of the Free State, has a major poem in which Table Mountain is returned to its indigenous identity as Hurikwaka, or the sea-mountain. There are, of course, precedents for Coetzee's seminar on literatures of the South, one of which is the Writing the Deep South conference that Ariel Dorfman convened in Santiago in 1998, and which sought to foster exchange between Chile, South Africa, and Australia. In a later reflective account, Dorfman says that he at first really failed to find commonality across these latitudes, particularly with Australia. He saw it with South Africa, and in fact at the time he has been much evoked in South Africa. It was during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and we were all reading Death in the Maiden. But he talks about arriving in Sydney and walking around downtown and just not seeing what the Southness might mean. But according to his retrospective account, and this is the detail that excites me, he goes for a walk on a beach in Cape Town, and at that moment, the constellation of the South clicks into place for him. Okay, and I think we can see what it does for him, what this little space does for him in his opening address, when he starts to identify the commonality between these places, which I think he locates in what I would describe as a literal or ecotonal condition. Our countries, says Dorfman, have been constituted through encuentros, encounters. The encounter of humans with a nature that is turbulent and immeasurable and hard to tame. The encounters with the Europeans and their descendants meeting those who resided in our lands before the arrival of these foreigners. The encounters of our natures over and over with the outer world to the north that influenced and modeled and used and demanded and claimed us. The encounters with frontiers, always with frontiers. And then I'm reminded of Mary Louise Pratt's study of imperial travel writing, which is to date, I think, one of the few sustained accounts to think across Southern Africa and South America. And she presents the idea of the contact zone, which has been taken up as a framing concept in one of the, again, relatively few attempts to read Australian literatures as a literature of the literal zone. So all these sort of resonances to think through. Let me conclude by asking then, what kind of world is the South? These writers all suggest that one way of answering that question is to ask, what kind of place is a shore? What kind of place is a strand or a beach? And I want to leave in play the various connotations of abandonment, of fortification, of that which washes up unbidden, and which arise on these shores with those who burst upon it from out of the blue. But I want these. But I think these connotations remain in a state of ebb and flood rather than stabilizing in this fluctuant zone of encounter, transition, and interfusion between maritime and terrestrial worlds. I want to suggest, perhaps whimsically, that it is in this mercurial state of meeting and merging that the South might again be imagined and inhabited as home. But if so, it will be one that, encircled as it is by the home of Friday, necessarily maintains an opacity. The dazzling shore does not, after all, only illuminate. It also blinds and obscures. So I want to end with these photographs from Coetzee's boyhood experimentation with that other medium that informs many of his novels' reflections on frames and borders, as well as on the indexical and analogic relation between representation and the world. They take us back to Strandfontein, the beach that John conjured up during his flight to the metropolis. And I won't comment further on them, as I think both the images and the caption speak for themselves, precisely by being unable to say very much at all. Thank you.